Welcome to an Electron Dance podcast. I'm Joel Goodwin, also known as HM, and today I'm talking across time zones, cultural barriers, and pay grades to speak to Richard Hoffmeyer, author of Cart Life. And I've talked a little bit about Cart Life over January. I think I spent a good 2 weeks on it, and I do like to plug it every chance I get. But I don't have to worry about that too much anymore because it's turned up on Rock Paper Shotgun and now also Kotaku. So Richard Hoffmeyer is now very wealthy and has the amount of money that Bill Gates could only dream about. So welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So I have to ask you, who are you? What is it you do?
Well, I'm just a regular fella, humble beginnings, humble life these days. It's Seattle these days, from Montana originally, in the snow mountains. Followed a girl here. We lived in Oregon for a bit and ran an art gallery there. Most of my career is in the realm of fine art and illustration and web design and that sort of thing. And then followed the same girl back up here to Seattle. So we're here for the second time and making games these days. She works in news, and she's been a journalist. So I had these really terrific dynamics throughout our relationship where she'd fight with the chief of police or the mayor's office and getting these terrific battles and come home flustered. And I'd show her cartoons of turtles and things that I'd just pour my heart out over and get very sensitive to.
Did any of those slip into Cart Life? I saw a few homages to various video games, but no turtle pictures, right?
No, I don't think there's any turtles per se. Maybe a couple of puns related to turtles.
So you used to work at this gallery, Inkthirsty?
That's right. In Eugene, Oregon. It was my own gallery, which I figured was probably the best way to find a home for my own work. Instead of trying to solicit interest from gallery owners and curators, I thought I'd just open my own and then have a nice captive audience of friends and housemates and things to inflict my work on. So that was nice. We showed sneakers and video games and graffiti and things. Eugene's a terrific town. In fact, when we opened the gallery, Eugene's official city motto, I don't know if you have those in the UK, city mottos.
Not so much, but...
We certainly do in the United States. A very capital concern for us that our cities are marketed as well as possible. And in the case of Eugene, it was the world's greatest city for the arts and outdoors. It's verbatim. It's so weird. But after we opened the gallery, the city council met and reclassified the motto as being a great city for the arts and outdoors. It's no longer the best. And I can't help but feel a bit responsible for the demotion. I think our little gallery may have had something to do with slipping from supreme excellence. We issued a press release apologizing for that, but nobody really ran it.
Was your gallery in the outdoors? I'm not sure. Did you actually hit both of those?
See, we should have done this interview years ago. Maybe we'd still be open.
What was it that drove you to actually game development? I'm assuming it wasn't drink.
Well, no. I couldn't afford booze. otherwise, it may have been. Or I guess if I could have afforded booze, I might not have needed the games. Something about their capacity for art. I mean, it gets very snooty. I get very snooty about it. And I think the games have a unique potential for exploring and things that cinema and theater and books and poetry, and they lack the interactive component or something. I mean, I'm still learning, but the more I make games, I mean, Cart Life is really the first game that I made. I mean, there have been other small ones. This is really the first full one. But the more I learn about it, the more I'm kind of humbled to that audacity that drove me to explore making them in the first place. Like I said, my career before this stuff, and I'm still doing it now to pay the bills, is more in the realm of illustration and fine art and things, and web design and stuff. And so I'm pretty well acquainted with many of the devices used in those mediums to solicit emotion and to stimulate folks. And I think that, like, I've always played a ton of games, much more than my fair share as a kid and growing up and throughout adulthood as well. And kind of seeing them mature, it seems like something I could make a contribution to.
Mm.
I mean, again, I'm kind of learning to be a bit more humble about that audacity the more I go on with it. It's
hard. Well, that humility, it's great. You probably just, as you get that humility, then you get lots of exposure, and then you've just put it in the trash can and move on with lots of pride. That's what we decided. The opposite of humility was pride.
I think so. I'm more well acquainted with pride, and maybe that's why, if it doesn't work out with games, that'll be why. it's not a natural fit for me to be very narcissistic like that. But I have to say, your article's kind of, it's really fed that narcissism in me. I can't account for it. I was speaking with Owen Good from Kotaku yesterday.
Yeah.
About this kind of irony. There's kind of a full circle irony to it, that I wouldn't have made Cart Life if I didn't have this kind of reckoning with modesty and with, you know, taking grand ambitions and learning the difficulty of life. I wouldn't have been able to confess the experience of Cart Life if I hadn't had all this grand ambition kind of fizzle out. And then in making the confession, now there's more praise than I'm really used to. And so now I'm starting to become a bit more of an egoist as a result of the feedback. And so it's kind of ironic. So maybe the next game will actually, I mean, Zynga's right down the street. Maybe they'll hire me. I don't know.
No, they'll probably just clone the damn thing, and that'll be the end of that.
I think Cart Life is a good fit for them. Cart Life 2 would be a great Zynga property.
Yeah, I could certainly see those little nice grindy mini games being quite helpful. So why did you end up on Adventure Game Studio as opposed to all the other options out there?
I knew that it was object-oriented, just kind of a nuts and bolts thing, and I'd played around with interactive fiction a bit, tads and things, and so I knew a bit about just the most superficial elements of scripting. And also Yahtzee Croshaw's Art of Theft was really a compelling title for me at that time, because indie games, all of that nonsense, was totally new to me. I had no idea. And so, well, here's the whole story. I'll do my very best to be terse, and again, that's not in my nature. So I'll probably go a bit long, but I'll try to be terse. So I was working at doing all the Yellow Page ads as a graphic designer for a phone book in Mount Vernon, Washington, home of American journalist Glenn Beck and little else. And I was making my own hours for this phone book bureau. And so I was there at 2 in the morning, and I had music up on all of the computers, and the whole office was the only one there. And I decided in that moment that I wanted to make video games. And so I was looking at other folks who'd done it as in the spirit of an artist, or as maybe a novelist or something like that, because the tools had been made available to us individual folks, and so we don't have to work for companies and things. We can afford them, and Adventure Game Studios is for use. And if somebody like Yahtzee Croshaw was able to make The Art of Theft with such an engine or with such a tool set in so short a time, then I could probably do the same. And it seemed like a good place to start. So I gave myself 30 days from when I got home. And made a really awful platformer-ish thing called The Jackyard. And I did it in 30 days, and I did all the music and backgrounds and things. I was very happy with it because it works and it was functional. And then I thought, well, for my next trick, I'll make a game about street vendors, and I'll do it in 30 days. And I'll just make a game every 30 days until it ceases to be sustainable engagement. And
it's a lovely plan.
Yeah, it certainly was. I was quite fond of it at the time, 30 days to make Cart Life. I did kind of blow past that deadline a bit. It took me about 3 years to make Cart Life, so I missed my deadline.
You didn't fire yourself, which I think is quite quite admirable.
Well, I withheld pay until the delivery, so I'm a tough client that way.
So, while you've brought up the Jackyard, yeah, I have played the Jackyard. And it's interesting. I don't get that feel like it has some sort of, what's the word? It doesn't have a consistent theme to it. It feels like a bit of a lots of stuff thrown together. But it has a does have a weird vibe about it. I did actually enjoy it. It's got the kind of sort of like a mechanical strangeness to it, which really took off in Cart Life, I think. Like, you know, you jump on the bed and then you say, would you like to sleep? And it's like, really? Okay.
It's pretty sloppy. I often toyed with the idea of just removing it. I mean, it was an exercise and learning to script. And I also wasn't acquainted. It's a very common mistake among amateur creative types of any medium, really. And it's that I hadn't done the good work of acquainting myself with my predecessors or my contemporaries, meaning that lots of atmospheric platforming, side-scrolling, exploration, moody engagements had been made very well and with a kind of grace and finesse that the Jackyard could have learned a lot from. But I didn't do it. I thought, no one's ever made anything like this before, and I'm going to impose my will on the world. And
I wonder, though, that... you know, something like if you had done lots of research into, you know, how other people are doing these kind of things, maybe you wouldn't have made Cart Life, because Cart Life essentially goes down lots of roads which people have sort of like said, look, you know, that's a grindy mini game. That's a waste of time. Don't bore people and don't throw people right into the thick of things, because you know what? People are just going to turn off your game after 5 minutes. And right. You've done all that. And maybe if you did research, you wouldn't end up with Cart Life. So perhaps...
I see your point. I think that maybe there's something of the independent spirit of games that may have softened those parts of it. I think you're right about that. Nonetheless, a lot of that stuff is made in opposition to the kind of false compliment of mini games in mainstream titles. Yeah. I realize this kind of sophomoric indies versus AAAs is pretty tired and. I certainly don't have much to contribute to it, but nonetheless, at the time when I started Cart Life, there's something in doing kind of grudging toil kind of work that, especially switching between the mouse and keyboard, that's supposed to evoke kind of intangible satisfaction from doing just manual work. I've had a lot of kind of those types of jobs. Never been a street vendor. Cart Life talked me out of it. You know, worked at copy stores and, you know, was a cook and dishwasher, all those jobs. And there's something about, it's an intangible quality of doing work that's time-consuming, it's time-consumptive, and it's demanding of a type of attention, but it's not wholly encompassing, and it's certainly not exciting, that I think that games might benefit from in that way. And that's why they're there in Cart Life, obviously. And your articles handle that very carefully. I feel like I've been very lucky to have these other journalists as well. So certainly yourself too, Joel, play the game with such care and it's this generosity. Because in the experience of having it in the gallery, it was really nice. Folks who aren't so well acquainted with video games, coming up to the arcade cabinet of Cart Life, and it has the keyboard and the trackball and things.
Yeah.
And they hated it most often. And it was terrible. They'd give me a look like, why would you make this, though? Like, not just that it was kind of deliberately frustrating or cruel or kind of, not just that it was demanding of patience and there's a lot of information being thrown at them without the tools to discern relevance and things, but also that the amount of time that went into the game was evident just upon their initial evaluations of it.
Yeah.
They could just look at it and this is a lot of work, but it's not fun. So why would you put so much time and work into something that's so clearly meant to be unenjoyable?
I wasn't generous. Just because I was generous, I mean, it was as I said in the article. It was like I decided I had enough of the game when I realized it was time to make coffee all the time, and I thought I was going to do this once, right? I make coffee once, and then okay, I guess it'll just be like press a hotkey or something because I've done it once now, and it was like no, you have to do this again and again, and I'm like okay, fine, I'm done. but it's the rest of the game, the whole harness of the thing in which that is sitting, gives it a lot more life than just that simple mini game. And I think that's a sort of its plus. It's the fact that, you know what, you want to live this life, you have to live this life. If you want to see more of it, you have to do this. This is what it's all about. And somehow that works. And there's plenty of other games which do this kind of grind, and it doesn't work because they're more focused on the grind, saying, ha, do you know real life? It's a grind. End of. That's it. Why did you work on it for 3 years when essentially it was, it obviously felt like something that wasn't supposed to be innately fun?
Right. Well, it's, I think mostly there's something about, I couldn't leave it unfinished, even though it'll never be finished. It never will be. I had a really rewarding conversation with Tarn Adams and his brother Zach.
Dwarf Fortress.
Here in the place when I first moved to Seattle, I was writing for a magazine called Pork out of Eugene. Fantastic magazine. There's my pork plug, by the way. And I interviewed Tarn and Zach about Dwarf Fortress, and they it was so inspiring. I don't want to be trite about it, but Tarn is a rare genius. He's a professional mathematician. That's a vocation I didn't even know existed. I thought we had math figured out. And so this is a genius of the rarest type. And he's dedicated his life to making a fantasy simulation, a fantasy world generator, he calls it. And I think that, like, us as just video game players or people, anyone, just as human beings, we're very lucky to have Tarn Adams dedicate his life to making this thing, which is not just high art. It's not just unprecedented entertainment. And it's not only very useful in science. And, you know, Dwarf Fortress is loved by academics, but it's his whole life. He's dedicated everything to it. And he sacrificed a great deal to make it better. And it's ongoing. It's perpetual. It also will never be finished. When I was working on Car Life, I was totally awful to be around. My girlfriend, Jenny, is a saint, and she tolerated the worst of it with a terrific smile. She's a very charismatic girl. She listened to me talk about another fella who I kind of admired in a similar way, is a Russian animator named Yuri Norstein. And he's a bloke who, in the 70s, a national treasure for Russia, and most animators will say he's the greatest there has ever been. He was very prolific at the time, making a lot of short pieces. And he, at some point, I don't want to get my history wrong, but it's in the late 70s, early 80s, he decided to dedicate himself wholly to recreating an animated telling of Gogol's Overcoat story. It's a very simple, really tragic, sad Russian classic. And he's been working on that since. And I think it's intended to be about a half hour, and he's about 8 minutes in. He's got about 8 minutes of it finished. And he's cranky. He's very Russian, bearded, lives in the woods with his poor wife, who has to listen to him be all cranky. And he's furious, and he hates computers. He hates his interns, and he hates his funding nonsense. He just wants to dedicate himself to his art. And I was sitting in my just completely naive adolescent way in Eugene with my coffee and, you know, living a great life and just being so miserable and, I have to finish this thing. It's so important. It has something about meaning and about how games can be both fun and kind of a form of escape or incidental leisure education, but also they maybe something serious. I don't know. I made the mistake of taking it dreadfully serious.
When you released it last May, did you feel it was ready? I mean, it sounds like, you know, oh, this will never be finished. Was it one of those things where you say, okay, I think I should stop before I kill everybody in my life?
Yeah. I wish I could say so. I think it was, I mean, again, I really do think it was Jenny who helped me come to that conclusive stage of it. I come up here, it's having a trouble kind of finding work in my line of kind of freelance. Things have really dried up, especially in advertisements. It's usually the budgets that are are usually trimmed first, and that's my line of work. So kind of having a dry spell professionally and just being miserable about cart life, Jenny really imposed on me that it was time to start something new, because cart life could be infinite. There's the bus depot, and there could be other cities. There could be, so, and it was her, she convinced me to pair away the fourth character, Logan. There's more about that on the cart life message boards, I suppose. But there's supposed to be four characters. She helped me. She was very buggy and problematic, a story and things. And so we put it together, and then my older sister is having a baby shower in Ohio. And so on that weekend, we got some champagne and strawberry ice cream, uploaded the zip file, popped the champagne, and ran to the airport and washed our hands of it. I'd promised Jenny that I wouldn't obsess over people's reception of the game. I wouldn't even look at the internet until I came home. And I'm glad I cheated in that way, because I made the personally very memorable mistake of releasing it in an unplayable state. Somehow, this enormous charge shot of work, 3 years of life dedicated to this game, and then upon its release, it doesn't even work. You download it and it won't open. There's just a driver file missing from the zip that just slipped my mind. So I'm glad I cheated, and I took a peek at the AGS, Adventure Game Studio, message boards. And an easy thing to fix, fortunately, just a file missing. But nonetheless, concluding it was tough, because it could always be better. It could, I mean, especially with the amateur characteristics of the scripting, which I'm still dealing with now in the form of bugs. The problem with, I think, like programmatic logic being done poorly in scripting is that it's very delicate to fix problems. With more efficiently scripted coding, fixing problems is much more easy. And so going into cart life to fix bugs is kind of murky, because things are interreferential. It's like a house of cards. And
yeah.
So if you take one thing out and the whole, yeah, it's very tricky. And so in that way, it's kind of a rock that could be forever polished. You know, you could pare away the burrs and trim up the game in so many ways, not to mention the art assets, which are just a sponge for intention. You can look at any element of work in the game, and it could be improved. That's certainly how I feel. And I think it's probably that way with most forms of art. Writers and painters that I've had the pleasure of knowing feel the same about the work they do.
I mean, that was one of the things that worried me about when you were doing the bug fixing, because I thought, you know, I know how tightly coupled everything is in that game, and I could imagine that if you fix too many bugs, we could be creating more bugs over here in the corner.
Yeah,
and I think when you went to 1.3, you created another problem with Melanie, in which you had to do another 1.4 quickly.
Yeah, it's true. Just really quickly about the 1.3 thing, I only found it because I was it's so creepy, and this is the terrible narcissist that I am. It was 4 a.m. and I'm staying up and I'm watching someone live cast a play through of Cart Life. And there's like 3 people watching and they're all friends of the person playing. And then there's this guest, this mysterious guest who is me. And I'm uninvited. I'm watching this fella in his bathrobe play a video game. And he doesn't, it's very creepy. But anyways, he played through it, and so he's playing his melody, and he's excited. And he wakes up on the first day, and then, oddly, Laura, out of nowhere, standing over his bed, yelling about spiders. And he said, oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. And then everyone in the room said, oh, that's a shame. And then they quit. And I know that's the last they'll ever think of it. And it just broke my heart, because just a shot in the dark, this is the experience that someone has with a game, and it sucks, and it's just a terrible, inescapable mistake. And everyone who downloaded version 1.3 and played as Melanie had the same bug. That's it was awful. So the first thing, I fixed it immediately, but you're absolutely right, Joel, that it came around as a result of trying to fix a bug. So fixing bugs makes bugs, and It goes on forever. So eventually, there will come a time, and I hate to say so, I hate to even think of it, but there will come a day where I say, that's it, no more bug fixing. I don't care about this game anymore. I'm only working on new stuff.
So, I mean, it seemed like you worked on a little bit in terms of bug fixing shortly after it was released, but then I think the forums go sort of dead. It's like Richard Hoffmeyer is no more. And I just wondering what happened at that point. Was it more or less like, well, you know what, the reception hasn't been great, I'm not bothered, or was it, I've broken with this game now and I need to really walk away?
There was a bit of both of those circumstances where I thought maybe the game is asking too much of folks. It's too demanding. It's a very weird thing that it's trying to communicate, and I think that it necessitates a familiarity with games, and yet it's told as art. So it's really only in the shared territory of those two interests that people are going to get anything out of it. And then maybe during that time I thought I'd maybe try to communicate something too specific to too small a group of people, and so everyone who'd seen it, everyone who would see it had done so. And so it was time to move on to something, maybe something new. And then there was an odd kind of pulse of attention. And that's kind of how it's been. I'm just stunned because I'd kind of said goodbye to it a bit and began working on new stuff. And then I guess maybe it must have been early fall that Sweden, I'm sure certainly mispronouncing it. Is it Aftonbladet? Do you know?
Yes, yeah. I know what you're referring to, yeah. Yeah, I couldn't tell you how it's pronounced.
I don't know, but the journalist's name is Carl Johan Johansson. He's very fond of the game. And made mention of it through email and also on the AGS message boards. And then he wrote his piece for both blogemup.se and Aftonbladet, the daily. And he was kind enough to photograph the newspaper and send it to me. It was very gratifying. And I underestimated the scope of not only his appreciation of the game, but also the great exposure that would provide. I really had no idea. But it was interesting and baffling to have kind of a new surge of appreciation from folks who speak English as well as I do, but primarily communicate to each other in languages that baffle me. It's weird, you know. The internet, it's a really exciting time to be alive. You have no idea. Nobody knows. And then, a couple of other ones, mostly in Western Europe, though. Spain and Finland had publications about the game as well. France, of course. Pierre Corbinet's really terrific piece about it. And then he wrote for Milan Free as well. And that, it's fascinating, and I love it, the idea of that. And I also like, as an American, especially as like a pseudo intellectual, mm-hmm. someone who's very pretentious like me, it's a really comforting proposition, because I can tell people, especially my girlfriend's parents, I'm more well liked in Europe than I am here in the United States. Isn't that strange? Oh, it's weird. It's very weird. But it's also I like this the story of the deluxe cans as well, because it starts off like a huge brag and then it ends in a really weird way. And it's that we shipped cans to Malaysia and Russia and all of those places in Europe that I've mentioned, mostly to Germany and France and Sweden and Finland and England as well. But only one went to a destination in the United States, and it was to someone I'd never met. In Iowa, and they had kind of just a very American name. So, yeah.
So, what's it been like the last few weeks then? Because has the $5 bill started coming through the door again?
Yeah. Oh, well, quite a bit. I mean, I'm stunned. I'm unprepared, and I have no means to configure my vast appreciation for this wave of love, so much love. It's really hard to stay like moody and dark, which is usually my preference, because people are saying such kind things. I'm totally unprepared for this amount of love. I got an email from a young fellow, a young college graduate, who was asking me for career advice. He said, I want to make art games like yours. Tell me what to do. And it was a real struggle to inform him how misinformed he'd been in soliciting advice from me. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm not that guy. He should. I told him to contact Ian Bogost and Cactus, Terry Cavett. You know, there's people. There's a consensus on the people who probably best represent those ideals, and these are their email addresses. And from what I've heard, they're very friendly with folks like you. But I guess I really couldn't help myself and did give him some advice, like, you know, don't run out of coffee and try to find a really forgiving partner.
So did you then also then tell him that you basically don't get any sleep anymore because you're trying to fix these last few bugs?
Well, I wouldn't have any reason to say that because I do actually sleep really well. As awful as that is to say, I sleep damn well these days. Better than I have in years. Oh, it's awful. It's really funny sitting there with either or Jenny or my friend Evan was here this weekend for his birthday, and trying to be serious and stern and stoic while my email notifications from PayPal and from Google are just saying, hey, $5, hey, $5. And my smile is just, I can't suppress it. I keep smiling and I'm trying to remain serious, but I'm getting paid to make video games. Oh, I can't handle it. It's very exciting.
So in terms of current life's future life, I mean, I guess you just want to nail the thing down now, but I guess there must have always been things which you wish you could have, you know, put in. Maybe you could have saved Logan's life, the fourth character. Is there anything, I mean, I'm not going to push for Cart Life DLC because that would be a total sellout, man. Don't do that. But are there any things you want to put in?
It's not any notions of integrity. I hope that's not what's prompting you to say so. it's that I lack the technical expertise for providing people with DLC. If I knew how to do it, there's quite a bit of stuff in the game that I'd, and you can see, I suppose after maybe a second or a third playthrough, a few spots where there's dead ends or rough corners, things where content should have been added, and I intended to, but just didn't ran out of time or it wasn't a high enough priority. Mostly, I guess the primary thing in just general terms is that I would have liked to have made more just folks to populate the city. You see the same people around a lot, and I think that kind of dampens the immersive potential of the game, seeing the same customers walking around, especially at night. The scripting for their schedules and their individual proclivities isn't quite what it should be. Also, there's a few other destinations throughout the city that had a little more to them. But most of the stuff in there that I did actually finish, among the finished things, many of them are really concealed or kind of obfuscated behind seemingly irrelevant possibilities. Hmm. And again, it's the same dynamic of going to work or exploring the city that also conceals them as well. And so maybe kind of fine-tuning that characteristic of making the possibilities obvious to the player versus the kind of special joy that you get out of discovering something hidden.
Yeah.
I think that much of that could have been more well integrated. So it's small things like that. Also, there's the organic grocery store in Florence Gate Park. The shelves are kind of empty. I'd intended to make a lot of produce and, you know, apples and bananas and things like that. More cooking and things. More conversations with Laura. There was a video store where Melanie could rent movies and things and then talk with her sister and Dar about that stuff. I guess primarily, more than anything, it's the relationships in the game that are most lacking to me now when I play through it in testing.
Yeah.
It seems pretty profanely lacking, if I might say so, because especially that the game presumes that main thing at stake for everyone in the game is their relationships and their experience of sharing witness with other folks, and then it does a poor job of letting you interact with those with those very people. If I were in your shoes, I suppose, as maybe a games journalist playing this game, I'd probably find that most worth bitching about, I suppose. There's kind of a paradox in games, like I've mentioned to you before. It's and I think that Electron Dance does a terrific job of excavating this dynamic, and it's that games exist as a medium that demand to be played with and manipulated, and yet the more that the player does these things, they're risking not only the possibility of future enjoyment of the game, but they're also accelerating the entropic decay of their memories of the game as well. The more you play any game, the harder it is to remember with any fondness your first experiences, because of course now you know how that experience was constructed or imposed on you. You realize kind of the puppetry of a game after you've mastered it.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to respect it. It's hard to still love it. I think it's really true, and it's something that's always at risk in the medium.
It's funny because what you're saying there about, you know, in terms of, you know, if you replay and replay, or you play more and more and more, you can spoil the game and spoil your initial impression of the game. The number of times you read reviews which say, I thought it was all great, and then I replayed it and realized it was all lies. And, you know, I could never get killed in that room. And this is kind of like, you know, I'm seeing there's lots of discussions online about there are people who believe a game should be more about rules rather than the narrative. And
right,
those guys,
playing, right? Yeah, it's troubling to me. When I was making my failed attempt at games journalism, I said, and not only the Dwarf Fortress piece, but also something I wrote about Snakes of Avalon, which is another adventure game studio piece. That the only reason to play any game is for its story, and I guess I meant that, and I still feel that way. I do, and I think it's either the deliberate, intentional narrative of the developers, or in the case of something like maybe best represented by Dwarf Fortress or Spelunky, even something more emergent. I think that as a player, we can't engage with either system without creating a narrative for our own enjoyment of it. So we create a story from a Dwarf Fortress playthrough. And for me, I mean, that's, Tarn Adams calls them the after action reports, but these epic tales of histories of populations and the heroes, it's fantastic. And they're entirely in the head of the person playing the game. And it says more about the game's player than it does, I think, about how well made that game is. Maybe it's easier for me to say that after having spoken with him about it and his kind of disinterest in imposing his own visions on the players. And really, it's just a tool for soliciting imaginative work from the people playing. It's really interesting to me that he does that, but it doesn't change my mind about the only reason to play it is for the story. And so whether it's Game or Cart Life or Dwarf Fortress or Spelunky, I think that the narrative is the only game mechanic. That might not go for something like Tetris or maybe SimCity or something, those toys. It kind of deteriorates that dynamic of it's just a semantic problem that we call them all games when, of course, only some are games and some are toys and some are more like movies. Yeah, I guess in a perfect world, we'd have a term for them. I don't want to be childish about it, but it for me, the semantic problem is hugely consequential. And if we had a term like, I guess it's all interactive fiction, really. And that would be one host, one hemisphere. And then maybe games could be more precisely used, that term.
Yeah.
But interactive fiction, too many syllables, it's very academic and pretentious. We don't have a good word for it. Like, movies is a great word, which is fun to say. It's plural, and it describes the one uniting characteristic of a whole spectrum of propositions. And they're all united in that they're moving pictures. And games are just interactive. They're not games. They're just interactive. And that goes for board games and card games. But video games is an awful, really blunt instrument of language to use to describe shit that It has no business being called a video game. You know what I mean?
Maybe I'm, there's this, going back to the thing about the narrative, it's just, there's this difference between, there's sort of like the emergent narrative you're talking about, especially when you've got a game, something like Dwarf Fortress, which isn't really pushing a story at you. It's got so much depth and color and complexity that you don't know what's going to pop out at you. And then on the other hand, you've got something like, I don't know, Heavy Rain or any modern kind of shooter game, you know, Deus Ex or whatever. And they've got something that's authored. And basically, if you play it more than maybe a couple of times, you understand it. There's your book, start and finish, and you can see all the cracks in it as well. And I think going back to Cart Life, I think the interesting thing about Cart Life in terms of its design, which has taken me a little while to try and get to the bottom of, but it's the sort of like, it has so much, it has a lot of depth to it. There are a lot of different characters and the lives of everybody and different things that can happen and places you can go. But the game hideously constrains you, prevents you from exploring all that. And so in that sense, it sort of solves that problem, because you play it once and think, wow, it's really, really interesting. You try and play it again, then you can see some of the cracks appear, but after that you don't want to make coffee anymore, and you never play it again, so you never see any of those other stories. So it's great. It's a strange way of it actively prevents you from exploring it. It's like you say, all modern games these days, the modern mainstream approach is to make things easy to play. It doesn't piss you off, you just get on with it, and hell, look, just quick load, go back, you know, and just do that bit again, and so you can explore whole dialogue trees and everything. But you can't really do that in Cart Life, and it stays real by that constraint.
I'm glad to hear it that way. See, I feel like that comes from just my insecurity as a developer in the player experiencing many of those things on imposed terms. When I was a teenager, I was really interested in interactive fiction. And I came across something in, I'd have to paraphrase it now, I certainly don't remember it verbatim, but Andrew Plotkin, genius, another one of those rare geniuses that we're so lucky to have making games. But he said something that I've kind of oriented myself in opposition to, and it's that he said he'd hate the idea of spending time developing things that the player would never see.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the best part, is that as a player, it's no longer a false compliment to discover something. If you're at risk of having not seen it, that's a really poorly articulated way of putting it. But if you don't play the game every time through and get the same experience, otherwise the sensation of discovery is false, because it's not really your discovery. It's the developer telling you that you've accomplished something.
Yeah.
When really you're just doing what's expected of you. But maybe, I mean, I'm taking this really kind of out of a healthy relationship dynamic between a developer and a player. And there's kind of this affective, emotional combat and false compliments and dishonesty. But I think it's something inherently at risk in games. And that's something in Cart Life that I want people to at least have the opportunity to experience something that is authentically rare and maybe unusual, because it's the only reward that they'll get.
Yeah.
Because they're still at risk of by not working and by exploring the world outside of what they should be doing. It's the only reward that they could possibly get for their sacrifice, I suppose.
Because it also explains to some extent how your unfinished bits, you know, the stuff you just couldn't like finalize, can pass by, because you're never quite sure what something is, just like a loose end, and what you just haven't had time to explore. And it smooths, by preventing players from exploring everything, it actually smooths over bits which might fall short. I mean, there's things like, I don't even know what the computer's for in Melanie's house. I never worked that out. And there's also I did actually my last playthrough end up going in that other hotel. It's, I think, I can't remember where it is, but there's a hotel somewhere, and you can go in it. I thought, I wonder if I can get a rent a place here, because Andrus had been chucked out of his apartment. And no, there's just some guy standing there telling me to get the hell out. Just like, okay. Yeah. And also the train station, you can get a ticket there. Like, oh, God, I want to try that sometime, because that looks like a game ender. And it's all that kind of stuff. Is like, there's things in there which I don't know if they go anywhere or whether it's simply stuff which has been left in there. And, you know, curse you, Richard Hoffmeyer, if you say anything right now.
Well, I guess just for liability's sake, I will say that all of it leads somewhere. Every scrap of it, every loose end actually leads you to something grand and supremely consequential. There's nothing incidental in that game at all. It's all the results of very careful thought and implementation.
Don't worry, I'll edit this bit out. So there's just an important question I need to ask, which is, oh, hang on. I think I've got a bit of a headache. Hang on a second. Okay, that's better. I just needed to eat. I can go back to small talk now. do you actually tip in real life? Because I couldn't get you to tip in the game at all.
You know, I don't want to. Well, it's very truthful portrayal of real life. I'll say that. I think you nailed it. In the comments for one of the earlier posts, you said that in game Richard is verbose. He tells these long, weird stories, and you think that he's grown fond of you. And then you give him his coffee, and then he leaves without giving you a tip. I have to say, I mean, my primary interest is in being honest about portraying folks. Many of the characters in Cart Life, certainly not all of them, but many of them, are real folks and friends of mine. And I did that for a reason, and it's so that I could orient the game to kind of this mundane and really truthful portrayal of life. And I think if I would have made up all of the characters or based them, made composite characters and things, it would have been harder to configure that device for realism. And so, like, I spent a lot of time in the walk cycles of folks. I wasn't very good. I'm better now. But anyways, a lot of time was spent on those really terrible walk cycles, animations of people walking in different ways and things. And their jokes, their mannerisms. The guy who forgets his wallet is my brother, Tony. And he does forget his wallet quite often. It's a truthful thing, annoying as it is. Even more creepy for a couple of weeks than I normally am when I'd interact with my friends, because I'd be memorizing their little jokes and their speech patterns, their mannerisms. I'd watch very carefully how they dealt with waiters and waitresses, cashiers and street vendors. And then I would mercilessly and very insensitively, or maybe it's not a lack of sensitivity, it's just a lack of courtesy, I suppose. And I portray them in these really terrible ways, because people who are impatient, their patience meter goes by more quickly than other folks. I'll say this, maybe this will be useful to you. The person with the fastest patience meter in the game is a fellow named Steven.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, there you go. I've never met this person, but he's a real human. And he is just a guy who started a Twitter account to bug me to finish the game. And I was so grateful to his impatience that I did finish the game. It was a big part of getting it done on time. It was just that this guy who I'd never met and had really no reason to care, except he just wanted to play the game. It really warmed my heart, but his impatience is rewarded by his immortal incarnation as the most impatient person in the whole city.
I think that's brilliant. You know, you've got all this stuff on Kickstarter where if you donate a certain amount of money, you get a free T-shirt, and then maybe you get a character name after you. I mean, I think that's the kind of thing you could probably say. You could have the most impatient character in the city named after you.
There you go. I think for future games, I'm very intrigued by that notion of paid premiums and things. My friends are trying to talk me out of it, but for the next game, which is a dinner mystery, it's a very genre story, I'm thinking of, for $1 million, US dollars, we will fly to your town and we'll act out the dinner and you can play the player character in an interactive theater and we'll eat all the food and we'll act it out and things and we'll really kill somebody at the end and you have to solve the murder for $1 million. Things like that. It's really intriguing to me that, because again, with the internet, you don't know. You never know. There's a whole world of people out there. And who knows? Who am I to presume that they wouldn't want to give me a lot of money for something really silly and indulgent like that? I don't want to deny them the possibility of giving me their money for something silly, so I'll at least provide them the opportunity to do so. So we'll see.
You might have a lot of friends in the 1%. You never know. You never know. So that's that was the Blood of the Ortolan. Is that how it's pronounced?
That's right. That's right. It's a. So
that's out next month, right?
Well, we'll see. Like I said, I'm not really great with deadlines. I hope to release it on Halloween, which even then was late. I made it for a 48-hour game competition, and that was in September. And so it'll be released probably February. We have actual actors, professional actors, doing the voice acting. At first, I had this strong auteur theory urgency, and I wanted to, because I drew all of the art. It's no longer pixel. At first, it was kind of pixely, but it's more comic book style now, and so it's a little more time consuming. And then I thought, well, I've already drawn everything, and I've already scripted the whole thing, and I played and composed and played all the music, so I'll do all the voices too, all the males and females, and it'll just be just auteur top to bottom. That didn't really work out. The voice acting is awful. And so I happened to find these folks who are going to do the acting, and they're all really terrifically talented. It's a real stroke of luck that these folks are going to do it. But so that's the story of that. It's a dinner mystery, and it's very genre. It's that same Agatha Christie kind of notion that we're all familiar with.
And you're also writing A Brasher Imposter at the same time, right?
Indeed so. That one will probably be early summer. We're recording the music for my one of my very favorite bands in the whole world, Eugene, Oregon band, kind of a Argentinian tango ensemble. They also play just a variety of really terrific music. Mood Area 52 is the name of the band, and they're doing the soundtrack. My buddy Ryan from the Waffle Arcade Cabinet is helping me do some of the finer scripting components of it, and that'll be early summer. It's kind of a point-and-click adventure game about telling lies.
Yeah, I don't know. We've just got one piece of artwork currently for that, right? At least with the... with the foodie one, there is actually a YouTube video for that. Do we expect anything more to appear over the coming months, or is it just going to be like, it'll be done when it's done, okay?
Well, I've got this bad habit of over-promising and under-delivering, and I want to grow to do the opposite. And marketing games is an odd thing, and bragging about how good something is to people who might not enjoy it. It's a very strange proposition. I'm not very good at it. And so that, you know, all of those elements of talking about what resides within the game without putting the rewards at risk is tricky. I mean, everybody hates film trailers for that reason, right? Because they by their nature, they have to tell you more than you want to know. They have to, in order for the device to work. And I don't necessarily think that formula is super effective. And as, I guess, kind of the creative engineer responsible for the work, that's the last thing that I want to do is tell anybody anything about it. I wanted to experience it for themselves. And so kind of putting the artwork or making trailers or showing demos, also game demos, it's kind of a similar thing. There's folks who are really skilled at that. Dave Gilbert and Waja Eye Games, really terrific at kind of negotiating the dilemma of how much to show and how much to conceal. It's kind of a prolonged striptease, and he's really skilled at it. A lot of it's really tricky, and I'm no good at it. But we'll see, because there is, I think, especially with this Blood of the Ortolan, I think there's a lot that I want to show to folks to solicit their interest in getting it. Because there won't be a free version. It's going to be pay only. And I think I'm going to charge maybe like $200 for it. So we'll see. And so in order to pull that off, people want to know what they're paying for. And since it's a mystery, I don't want people to rely on games journalists to inform their purchasing decision, because there's great risk of compromising the rewards. So we'll see. It's tricky.
We're going to have to sell this thing by telling nobody anything about it. it'll sell itself through no PR.
Yeah, just trust me. It's really good. With the war game, Arbrusher Imposter, there's kind of a reveal at the end, kind of a final click that puts everything in context. And there's kind of, it's configured in a way that the reveal is the only satisfying moment. And so all of the game's fun is kind of condensed into this single instant. And so marketing something that's configured that way is, additionally, it's really tricky, because I realize that's vague, but it's vague for that reason. It's that to even say anything about it is to compromise it. And that's something that happens, I think, kind of often in games, and more so now. I guess You Only Live Once is a game like that, where the conceit can't be remarked on in the marketing of it, because it would compromise the fun of playing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the war game is, it's like a knock-knock joke that's told over a 90-minute period. So, really, yeah, anyways.
You better be a great joke teller.
Oh, well, you can tell from the interview how good I am.
So I have to ask, what is it that you actually find yourself playing these days? I see you got into The Cat That Got the Milk just this weekend.
Oh, yeah, stunning. Everything that team, each of them as individuals, I'm glad they've assembled. And that game is just such a treat. It's beautiful. It's so terse. It's like a haiku of a game. It's really fun. But honestly, I guess what I play lately is, I had Devin from The Waffle Story. He was up this weekend for his 16th birthday. We went to an arcade and we played just goofy arcade games and House of the Dead with guns and some historically relevant air hockey games. Really good. So there's, I'm still engaged in all of that stuff, and I'm kind of becoming a creepy old man who's longing for the lost magic of games. But War Fortress, I think, will endlessly fascinate me. It always will. It's a masterwork, and it's in flux at any moment. I mean, it's all subject to change, and it's going to get better in every way from now until the end of time. Similarly, I think Spelunky was so well crafted, and there's something profound about that game that I'm still kind of struggling to pinpoint. There's something I got a University of Washington student interviewed me for a paper, and he got me drunk at a bar nearby, and I talked about Spelunky being like an argument for the fundamental physical laws that govern the universe, instead of, say, like Mario Brothers, there was a divine creator who made the worlds for you to experience. So it's the intelligent design of Mario Brothers versus the evolution argument that Spelunky is total nonsense. Now I'm imposing it on you. So anyways, I guess that's what I've been playing. But the games of the really terrific AGS Bake Sale are certainly worth everyone's time.
You wouldn't have any games in that sale, would you?
Well, not per se. I did a port of a Korean game that I found at a garage sale in Seattle's Chinatown district. And it's kind of a Rock'em Sock'em Robots game, and it's all in Korean. That's part of it. But there's some really terrific ones. They're ambitious, and it's quite a variety of things. They all stand out. There's one called 9 Months In. It's a very standard kind of retro-centric point-and-click adventure, but it's told from a unique perspective, and the voice of its protagonist is that of pregnant prison inmate. It's an interesting protagonist to get behind in this kind of retrocentric context. But of course, Sebastian Fowler and Ben Chandler put together a game called Fragment, which is really terrific about a computer scientist negotiating his memories and a program that he created. But it's full of really good games.
I feel bad that actually I haven't. I've never attempted Dwarf Fortress because it's didn't seem like it was compatible with my life, and Spelunky, I played it the once, and I thought I'll have to have another go at this, and years passed.
If I'm presumptuous, I maybe make the suggestion of undertaking a liberal crime squad by Tarn Adams. I think that's just a Tarn Adams game, whereas Dwarf Fortress is Tarn and Zach. But I think Liberal Crime Squad is a nice, much more accessible piece of art to kind of breach the threshold of Dwarf Fortress with. It's a ton of fun.
Did RPS do a bit on that in their first year or whatever? I've got this feeling that RPS did a series on Liberal Crime Squad.
Oh, really? I haven't seen it.
It's like when they were just starting up and they had about two readers. And they managed to double it to four after that. I'll have to look back at that now. So I would say thank you very much for the talk to me, Richard, and I look forward to the other titles which we might see this year, hopefully at certain indefinite dates.
Hard at work. Thank you so much for your time.